morning.
Good morning, Judge Watanabe, Judge Fujise, and Judge Nakamura. My name is Edie Feldman, and I represent the defendant appellant Rick Patikin in this proceeding. Mr. Patikin was convicted of sexual assault in the third degree and attempted sexual assault in the third degree after a jury trial was held. The reason that we're here today is because the defendant contends that his Sixth Amendment right to confront his accuser was violated by the lower court's pretrial ruling. Specifically, Mr. Patikin was precluded from using the counseling reports that were provided to him by the complainant, a minor child, mother. At a pretrial ruling, the court ruled that because of the victim counselor and psychologist counselor privilege, and because of the argument that Article 1, Section 14 of the Hawaii Constitution was amended, these communications were deemed absolutely privileged, and he was precluding from cross-examining the complainant at trial, even if she testified differently.
I want to distinguish between the reports concerning the complaining witness and the reports concerning the mother. On what basis are you asserting that the court actually precluded a reference to the reports referring to the mother? My understanding is that both the state's motion in limine and the defense motion in limine referred to reports involving the complaining witness, not the mother. So how do we go from the motion in limine be granted as to that situation from saying that the reports to the mother were also ruled?
I'm glad you brought that up, because this is kind of a confusing issue in the case. On the day of the hearing of the motions in limine, Mr. Patikin received five reports. Three of those reports pertain to the complainant. Two pertain to the mother. On that same day, the deputy prosecuting attorney received two reports, one pertaining to the mother, one pertaining to the complainant. And for our purposes today, I really want to focus on Exhibits A and B. Exhibit A has to do with the complainant. Exhibit B has to do with the mother. But nevertheless, the deputy prosecuting attorney was given a copy of complainant's report and mother's report. Defendant got three additional ones, but again, we're just focusing on Exhibits A and B. After the father, by the way, the parents are divorced, and child had been living with the mom all this time. And so it's a question in my mind, well, how did the father get access to ex-wife's report and had the ability to turn that report over to the prosecutor on the day of the hearing? It seems like there could have been a mutual waiver. And the reason I say that is because he disclosed the contents of his child's report and his ex-wife's report to the deputy prosecuting attorney. Similarly, the mother disclosed the contents of her own report and her child's reports to the defense counsel. There may have been a mutual waiver going on. And the reason why the...
But now we're talking about whether the court's ruling applied to both reports.
The problem...
What basis is there for believing that the court... The fact that the... I understand the five reports were submitted at the hearing. All right, but the motion itself did not pertain to all five. The motions only pertain to the victim's report. So how does the fact that the five reports get submitted necessarily broaden the court's ruling?
I think what happened, Your Honor, is that there was absolutely no in-camera review. And there were never any distinctions made. Okay, these reports pertain to child. These reports pertain to mother. You are precluded from using these reports pertaining to child, but you can use these reports pertaining to mother.
Right, so you're just relying upon the court's reference to reports.
Correct.
As meaning both.
Correct.
And that's your basis for arguing that the court's ruling applied to both the mother's reports and the complaining witness report.
I also base that on the fact that the deputy prosecuting attorney received from the father mother's report along with child's report. He turned it over to the prosecutor. How did the father have access to mother's report?
Why couldn't mother have given it to father?
Definitely.
I'm trying to understand how you reconcile an absolute privilege with the fact that these reports were turned over in the CPS case, weren't they? Were they evidence in the CPS case?
I believe they were.
So why wasn't it an absolute privilege to preclude it from being admitted in the CPS case?
I cannot answer, Your Honor. However, what I want to point out, and this goes back to Judge Nakamura's point, is that you have to really examine these reports. And references to the child in the mother's report, I mean, these reports are really intertwined. And so when the judge rules that this is an absolute privilege, in order to abide by that ruling, defense counsel had to be very, very careful, because even though, Judge, you are correct, how could this happen where mom's records are somehow enmeshed with child's? But nevertheless, if you look at these two reports, there are strong references to the child all over. I mean, the mother's report is...
Is there anything in the record in which the court specifically says, I am precluding the defendant from using mother's report?
Specifically, no. The only thing in the record is the reports.
But in this case, the confidential communication covered by the privileges are the communication between the victim and the counselor or the client and the psychologist.
Correct.
All right, but in for the mother's report, any statement the mother made to the psychologist or the counselor would not involve a confidential communication of the child.
Correct.
So any privilege applicable to the child would not be affected by the mother's report.
That's correct, but you still have to understand that these reports were in the possession of the father. And so when the deputy prosecuting attorney has both reports and asserts the privilege on behalf of the child. As a matter of fact, if you look at the transcript really closely, she sort of implied that it was actually one report, but it was two. So perhaps when it was given to her, these two reports were actually combined. You have to look at it real closely because it looks like one report, but it's actually the two reports, one for the mom, one for the daughter.
You referred them to counseling with the entity that did reports A and B.
Who referred them to counseling? I don't know who referred them to counseling. It's my understanding that it's part of the process whenever there's an investigation for any kind of sexual abuse, that it is kind of automatic. I believe the family court probably ordered it.
So is that a confidential communication within Rule 504.1? Your position is it's not?
My position is that it's not, because
Didn't you concede that at trial? No?
The assertion
that
of
the privilege applied, and all you're trying to determine is whether our rule is constitutional?
That is exactly right. That was asserted at the hearing below, but I'm asking the court for purposes of plain error review, because they substantially affect the rights of the defendant to consider this issue. And more specifically, if you look at what the state has attached to their answering brief, State versus Mitchell, probably what should have happened is there probably should have been an inquiry as to whether or not there was a waiver of privilege. How did the father get the mother's report? Why did he turn it over to the prosecutor? What was his purpose? Because
isn't there a waiver of that? In other words, if you had asserted it below, then the record would be complete. But now you're asking us to speculate on what the evidence would have been when there's no record specifically on that topic, because the defendant stipulated that these reports were all covered by the privilege, and the only issue was whether the Constitution trumped the privilege. So, I mean, isn't there, even though there is that plain error standard, isn't this a kind of a difficult case to apply plain error because the record itself is not conducive because of the stipulation for us to apply the plain error standard.
It may not be conducive, Your Honor, but I do think you have the ability to apply the plain error in this particular instance. There are a couple more things I'd like to point out. Specifically, in Mitchell, there was this remand, and the purpose of the remand was to find out whether there was a waiver. And if there was a waiver of the privilege, then in Mitchell they already decided that the substantial rights of the defendant had been affected, and the testimony should have been allowed to cross-examine on the testimony. I think here, for our purposes, even if you found that there was plain error, and there probably should have been a hearing on that matter, in other words, was there a waiver of the privilege? Because Rule 16 would have required the prosecutor, once she became in possession of those two reports, she would have had to turn them over to the defense anyway, under Rule 16. But father asserts the privilege, and everything got very confusing, and I think the problem arose because there was no examination of those records. In other words, it's like the court turned a blind eye to make some kind of, you know, accurate and ruling on this matter. There were no findings made, no distinctions made, and again, because these reports were so intertwined, I think the defense counsel did the right thing. He abided by the court's ruling.
Let me ask you if we can address the core constitutional question. So assuming that the report, at least as to the complaining witness, was privileged, what is your argument as to how the Sixth Amendment or Confrontation Clause or due process right would affect whether or not the privilege holds in this case?
Well, you know, I think the Davis versus Alaska case is the most controlling case in this particular situation. And the reason I say that is because you'll notice that in that case, there was no evidence of motive. There was no evidence of motive. A young boy may have been a witness in a case, and because he had a criminal background as a juvenile, it was speculated that he may have had a motive to lie with respect to how he came upon the evidence. No evidence of motive, but it was the mere fact that he could have had a motive to lie that warranted reversal by the Supreme Court. In other words, this issue of motive is so important in the development of cross-examination. And if you look at Exhibit B, there's evidence of motive all over the place.
But why is it not harmless error in this case? Because the defense actually had those reports and used it to cross-examine the witnesses in this case?
Not to the extent that he should have been allowed, Your Honor, because he could not really develop his defense about what were the motives in terms of the complainant's retelling of the story. And there were inconsistencies in this trial. If you look at Exhibit A and compare it to what the complainant testified to at trial regarding how it happened, when it began, when she reported it, at trial, the complainant testified, "I told my mother that this happened every single time it happened." But look at Exhibit A. Look at Exhibit B. The credibility of the complainant is crucial to cross-examination, and that is how I think the Sixth Amendment right was violated, Your Honor. He may have been allowed the opportunity to ask questions, but he was really hamstrung by the court's ruling.
We have Pacetti, right, which is it's a balancing test. Is it your position that Pacetti is incorrect under the Sixth Amendment, or do we still have to do that balance? Assuming it's not absolutely privileged, isn't there some balancing test that the court has to do when faced with a privilege in deciding whether or not the defendant's confrontation rights or due process right trumps the privilege?
You know, this is an unusual case in the sense that in Pacetti, it was the defense access to the records, and in this case, the defense had the records, and now it's what do we do with the knowledge that we've gleaned from our review of the records? So in a way, the balancing test in Pacetti really talks about what do you do when you are subpoenaing the records of the facility that provided treatment and counseling, and what factors do you weigh in order to decide, does the defendant have a right to this information? In our case here,
in Pacetti, they knew what the information was. The information from the counselor was that the victim had said it didn't happen to the counselor.
Right, and
it's not a situation in which they're in the blind just trying to get records.
Exactly.
In Pacetti case, came up with this balancing test with the understanding and actually applied the test knowing what the purported information the defense wanted was. So I guess my question is, to the extent that that's the same as here, in other words, there's some indication by the defendant that he knows what's in those records, is it your position that Pacetti is the test that should be applied?
Yes, I do. I think Pacetti is still good law, Your Honor, and I want to highlight the fact that in Pacetti, the defense counsel was allowed to cross-examine the complainant about it didn't happen to the sister, but he wanted to explore this further and cross-examine her statement to the counselor that it didn't happen.
All right, but in Pacetti, they were dealing with a statutory privilege. Now, after the post-Pacetti constitutional amendment, we're dealing with a constitutional amendment. How does that affect the balancing test in Pacetti? Doesn't that mean that we should make it a higher burden for the defendant to overcome because now we're dealing with a constitutional privilege as opposed to a statutory privilege?
Perhaps, and you know, it is the question before this court, what is this privilege? Is it absolute? Is it quasi-absolute? I mean, that is really the issue you have to contend with, but I will submit to you that you may not have to contend with that issue if you find that there is a plain error with respect to the waiver of the privilege. Because if there was an evidentiary hearing on that waiver, you may not have to reach that question, but in my opinion, you still have to decide whether those reports contain information that would have allowed the defendant to effectively cross-examine the complainant and whether that could have contributed to his conviction. And if you find that, then it's harmless. It's not harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt.
You talked about a balancing test included the need, correct? In other words, whether you needed the confidential report to effectively cross-examine. So if the defense had access to other impeaching information that was of equal value to the confidential report, that would obviate the need for breaching the privilege in the particular case.
Right. But, you know, it's interesting because I've given this a lot of thought, and the only thing I could say is there's a real difference in counseling records between those statements that are part of a narrative as to what happened and why that would be relevant to a defendant's right to cross-examine the complainant about the events versus those statements that are purely therapeutic in value and would have no merit in terms of giving that information to the defendant. In my opinion, that would be the fairest way to approach these kinds of problems because those statements, they should, you know, when the credibility of the witness is at issue, and in this case, if you look at Exhibit B, when the motive of the complainant is at issue and her credibility, I think in this case you have to find that the error was not harmless.
All right, well, let me give you a hypothetical. So in other words, assume that the victim gives a statement to, an arguably privileged statement to his or her counselor.
Okay.
And then gives the exact same statement to the police.
Okay.
And testifies at trial inconsistently.
Inconsistently, right. Okay.
Wouldn't the fact that you could impeach with a statement, inconsistent statement made to the police, obviate the need to breach the confidential privilege?
Maybe not, because then there's a cumulative value of those prior inconsistent statements. And that issue, well, wait a minute, why did you tell the detective it was this way? Why did you tell the counselor that it was this way? But now, today in court, you're saying this way. So I think, no, I think the fact that there is an additional inconsistent statement would allow the defendant to explore that inconsistency in a fuller and more effective way.
Right, but under Pacetti, there is a need element. So in other words, it's not automatically that any time a defendant can say, this might help me cross-examine someone, the privilege is breached. There is some need-based assessment in Pacetti that we have to look at in deciding whether or not the particular confidential information that the defense seeks, somehow that they need it because they don't have access to other abilities to cross-examine.
I do think that would be fair, that the defendant would have to show some need and that the in-camera review would require the judge to make a decision as to the relevancy of the information contained in the reports.
But if we have an absolute privilege by the Constitution, how do you determine what you need to look at or How do you prevent the defense from going on a fishing expedition
Looking at the report? I think that was the whole purpose of the constitutional amendment, was to disallow fishing expeditions, but this is not what we have here. We don't have a fishing expedition. We have information at our fingertips that we're saying, hey, this is relevant to motive, this is relevant to credibility.
But I think what the trial judge was struggling with was the fact that if you take the position you can use it when it's supposed to be absolutely privileged, how do you prevent defense from getting these records surreptitiously and then saying, oh, I have a need now because I know what's in them?
I read that, and I don't really understand how a defendant could surreptitiously get the records. I don't know if that is a... My time is up. 5 more minutes, thank you. I don't really understand how a defendant could surreptitiously get this. However, but in Pacetti, that's a perfect example where the need was shown because the defendant had learned through another source that the complainant had said it didn't happen to the counselor. There the need was established. So in my mind, despite the constitutional amendment, I think Pacetti still nevertheless controls what standard is to be applied whenever there is the elements of the need and the weighing of the privileges. I think that Pacetti still is controlling, and I say that because if you look at State versus Pond, Pond did not overrule Pacetti. I know that is the state's argument.
Your position is that the trial judge didn't do any in-camera review, even though the reports obviously were made accessible to the trial court. Now, in applying the Pacetti test, since we now have the reports and we have the record, can the appellate court do the Pacetti review and decide whether or not, under the circumstances of this case, the court erred in excluding the reports?
Well, I think that the court would have to review the records on appeal in order to make that determination. But again, you know, there may be an issue regarding the waiver that may warrant a remand. But nevertheless, yes, I think the court does have to review the records. But I think that should have happened below, and perhaps we would not be here today. I don't think the prudent approach is to turn a blind eye and say, you know, absolutely privileged, I can't look at those records, and nor can you. It's very hard to unring the bell. It's very difficult, if not impossible. I think this court has to find that there is a reasonable possibility that disallowing the defendant to cross-examine the complainant could have contributed to his conviction.
Let me ask you one question before. On the prosecutorial misconduct claim, why wasn't the reference to CPS involvement and the guardian ad litem relevant to the mother's bias or interest or motive in testifying?
I think it definitely tainted the jury's impression of the mother as being unfit, in need of guidance.
Wasn't the state's theory something to the effect, though, that she couldn't admit knowing about the abuse because that then if she admitted that, she might not get the child back? I mean, isn't that a at least a plausible bias claim, and isn't bias always relevant when impeaching a witness?
Yes, it is definitely a plausible bias claim, but you know, I would submit in this particular case, the prosecuting attorney had the benefit of a psychological profile of the mother and was able to tailor her questions and her strategies at trial based upon her review of those reports that were provided. Unfortunately, the defendant could not rehabilitate that perception or that characterization that was painted of her. He was precluded by the ruling. And so in a way, it turned out to be really advantageous for the prosecuting attorney because she knew where the weaknesses were in terms of this mother's character.
So your argument is that the court's ruling basically left the defendant with one arm tied behind his back. He couldn't really use all the information that he had available.
That is the perfect analogy. Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court, James Anderson for the prosecution. At the outset, I'd like to say that the record reflects that Ms. provided defense counsel with all the reports. My citation is 1-5 transcript of proceedings at 19 to 24 and 26 to 27. In 2004, the state constitution was amended to make inadmissible communications between a sex assault victim, her counselor, her physician, her therapist. We learned three things from this, from the legislative history. One, this was in response to Pacetti, an attempt to overrule Pacetti. Two, in effect. Two, that the amendment sought to enshrine those privileges, 504.1 and 505, the relevant privileges. And three, that the amendment was effective only to the extent granted by the United States Constitution. Of course, we must give at least that. So, the state's position is, since this particular communication is inadmissible under the state constitution, we must look to federal law for guidance.
Do you read the constitutional amendment as being self-executing? Because no action was taken to amend the rules after the constitutional amendment.
And you know, that was a concern in the beginning for us until we started looking into the legislative history. Standing Committee Report 1149, page 2 of that says that they seek that the intent of this amendment is to enshrine those provisions in the evidence code in the constitutional amendment, in the Constitution. So it seems like it would be something later, like May provides a later act, but it seems like they're referring to those already enacted. But in any way,
all right.
Yes.
Let me ask you a question. Is the state's position that the evidence rules themselves are absolute privileges?
No, absolutely not. They're qualified under certain circumstances, you know. But this particular one is now absolute. Yes.
Okay. Explain that to me.
Okay.
Obviously, there are eight. For the victim counselor privilege, there's eight evidentiary exceptions
yes.
to the privilege.
Yes, like proceedings for hospitalization, mental health examination, proceeding against the therapist.
Okay, so in what sense is it absolute?
Because the state constitution has taken that one facet out, that the communication between the sex assault victim and her counselor or psychologist, 504.1 or 505.5, are absolutely privileged.
No, it says that... The legislature may provide by law for the inadmissibility of privileged confidential communications between an alleged crime victim and the alleged crime victim's counselor. And you didn't change the rules, so don't those rules constitute...
It means nothing's been enacted then. Enacted.
No. But in other words, assuming a crime victim made a statement to a counselor. Now, one of the exceptions is for perjury. So if the counselor believed that the victim testified at trial, perjure herself or himself, the counselor could breach the privilege, correct?
Absolutely, upon an offer of proof from the opposing party.
Okay, so I'm just trying to, because I understand that some of the federal cases have made a distinction between an absolute privilege and a qualified privilege. I'm trying to understand
from
the state's perspective, is this an absolute privilege or a qualified privilege? Because my view of it is, if it's a qualified privilege, there's less of a state's interest, everything else being equal, is less strong than if it's an absolute privilege.
Well, the only thing I can say to that then is that the legislature, to my view, took an aspect of a qualified privilege and made it absolute. That's all I can say. Yeah, I mean, that's evident to my view. It is, yes, I understand.
Well, wouldn't another explanation be they took a qualified statutory privilege and made it a qualified constitutional privilege?
Yes, okay.
Well, that's not quite the same as making it absolute, meaning there's no exceptions to the privilege.
Right.
So I guess I go back to, if it's an absolute privilege, why is it even being admitted into the CPS case?
Well, it shouldn't have been.
But if you look at the history, legislative history of the rules of evidence at 504.1, there was a lot of testimony at the time as to whether the privilege should apply to preclude suppression, I guess, of statements that are made in the law enforcement context. So if someone reports abuse and law enforcement refers that person to a victim witness counselor, that should not be suppressed because you know that that's going to be used in the criminal case, it's going to be used in the CPS case. What's the situation here? It seems like they made a distinction between purely therapeutic counseling reports and those that you know are going to be turned over to third parties for use in litigation.
I don't know if they made that distinction. I mean, in my context, you know.
And there was discussion about whether counselors that are funded by the state are can assert that privilege because they're funded by the state, and so you lose that personal therapist privilege. So how did that change when the Constitution was amended?
I think the Constitution made the communications privileged, absolutely inadmissible in a criminal proceeding, in that limited context.
Because you're always going to have the situation where the parent is in the CPS case because they take action quicker, right, in these civil proceedings. So the father or the stepfather in this case is going to have access to all those reports that are used by CPS in that proceeding. And so they're always, it's hard to unring the bell. How are you going to?
I don't know if the father's, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I don't know if the father had access to this. The record in my case says the mother gave it to defense counsel. And I don't know if a mother should have gotten her daughter's privileged communications. I think it was wrong for her to have that. She shouldn't be having those things.
You look at a CPS file and all those reports are in there.
Okay. Well, I take your word for it. I don't know that, you know. I really don't.
Let's go back to your position is the constitutional amendment overruled Pacetti as to the state confrontation clause.
Yes.
Tells Pacetti. All right. But the federal confrontation clause still is in play.
Well, there are two things in place here, and we have to distinguish between the confrontation clause and the due process clause. Confrontation clause was evident in Davis. Davis, the defendant there, made a particularized showing of attack on a credibility as opposed to a general attack, I want to find out if he's being...
All right, let me ask you this. The Supreme Court cases that were cited, both of them breached the privilege. So my question is, do you have any federal case under the federal confrontation clause in which a state-based privilege is not either subject to some kind of balancing test? Because my understanding of your argument is that it's absolutely privileged, like no exception, under no circumstance could the defendant ever, no matter what the victim said to the counselor, could never use that in a criminal case.
Yes.
And my concern is, or my question is there any case that you can cite me that says that there is, that it's absolutely privileged and you can never get it, since the two Supreme Court cases that I'm aware of either applied a balancing test or said the privilege has to give way to the confrontation clause, the due process clause.
Yes, I understand. No, and I don't. But I do, I can infer from these two cases, Davis and Ritchie, that there's no way, either under the confrontation clause or under due process, that this particular privilege should be breached. There is absolutely no, and it's very interesting. In Ritchie, the court said something very curious in saying that, CYS records, they are subject to certain disclosure in certain circumstances. But it's not like we're dealing with a state statute that makes communications inviolate, sexual assault communications inviolate. That would lead me to believe that they wouldn't intend, in the interest of comity and federalism, to overrule the state's determination of privilege.
The privilege in this case is not inviolate because there's also an exception that if a counselor obtains information that indicates there's a crime going on, they have the obligation to report it to the proper authorities.
The Tarasoff exception.
Right. So
right.
This is not an inviolate privilege. In other words, if a child who was a sex abuse victim who hadn't reported it to anyone else then reported it to the counselor would have to report it to the authorities, wouldn't he?
Yes.
All right, so how does that, why isn't the privilege inviolate in this situation? Isn't it analogous to the type of situation that was the court looked at in Ritchie?
No.
Because?
Because I have a state constitutional amendment saying that it's inviolate. You can't pierce the privilege. And they're not going to, they didn't even decide the issue. So my bottom line actually is, since our Constitution is subject to the extent provided by the U.S. Constitution, and the U.S. Constitution hasn't ruled on it, and we forbid it, we win. State Constitution wins.
Say that again?
Our constitutional amendment is subject to the U.S. constitutional mandates. Ritchie declined to rule on this specific issue. They ruled on CYS much more less confidential in nature.
Right, but Ritchie's holding is that the state privilege in that case had to give way to the due process clause.
Yes, it did, upon a particular showing. But they said also, we're mindful of the fact that this is CYS records are subject to disclosure. Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, because my privileges are subject, are qualified as well as the CYS records.
Right.
That
why
I understand.
Analogous? Why aren't we in the same situation as we are in Ritchie?
Because I have a state. Because as they pointed out in Ritchie, we're not dealing with a state constitutional or a state statute that makes inviolate all communication, and that's what this does in this narrow context.
So your position is because the state of Hawaii passed this constitutional amendment that it automatically trumps the federal due process clause and confrontation clause in all circumstances?
I do not say. I just say that these two cases do not allow the piercing of that privilege because they just don't deal with that very issue. If they did and they said yes, under the showing of materiality and favorable to the defense, sure, then we have to go, yeah, we have to give that at least. It would trump us, yes.
So you're saying that to the extent the U.S. Supreme Court has imposed a balancing test for analysis of due process and a confrontation clause in the context of whether those rights trump a privilege, that same balancing test would apply to the Hawaii privilege.
You know, I think the balancing test in Pacetti, for instance, only went to the confrontation clause, not the due process clause analysis. There, I mean, it's similar. There, I think in Pacetti, it was a need, it was a relevance, and then you can't get it anywhere else. Under the due process clause challenge, I think you have to make a materiality showing of favorable to the defense, and that's it. And then you get the in-camera review. That's under the due process clause.
All right, so you're saying that in this case, if the court did a materiality determination, okay, why not?
No, because it's absolutely privileged. He shouldn't be touching it. Shouldn't even be here in this
well,
hearing.
What do you do with Rule 501 then? Because that one says that except as required by the Constitution of the U.S. or a state or by statute, no person has a privilege to refuse to be a witness, refuse to disclose any matter, refuse to produce any object or writing, or prevent another witness from disclosing any matter or producing any object or writing. And so the only privilege is in Rule 504.1, which is qualified. It's pretty limited as to what is confidential communications.
Mm-hmm.
And you haven't changed it since the constitutional amendment.
Yeah. So I'm getting from you, you don't think that these established rules of evidence are a part of the amendment, were intended
I'm
to be a part of
you.
Well, I am. I think so, from that legislative history.
Support for that, I guess. You need to help us here.
Okay. No, I am. I believe that. But like I said, my bottom line, too, is that the showing in here was of particular, there's no showing at all. I want to attack.
Well, that's a different argument. That's
okay.
An argument that you don't meet the balancing test. I understand you're saying there is no balancing test because you didn't even get there. Okay,
right.
So on my hypothetical, the victim tells the counselor, I made it all up, it's a total lie, the defendant never abused me. You're saying that that's absolutely privileged because the state constitution made that a confidential communication with the counselor, even if the defendant knows for some reason finds out that that's, in fact, what the substance of the statement is, cannot use it at trial?
Yes. That's the way the statute, that's the way the state constitution provides, inadmissible.
And you think that's the way that the analysis should be under the due process clause and also the confrontation?
From what I read so far, yes, because because they haven't dealt with this type of privilege in the cases that I've seen.
All you're saying is there's no case on point. You're not saying that if you analyze the cases under existing case law, although they may not have addressed this particular fact pattern, that they're necessarily going to come out your way.
I don't know if you can compare CYS records, probation records, against a different animal, against a state constitutional amendment making inadmissible these communications in a criminal proceeding. I think it's apples and oranges. It's that you just can't jive them.
So your trump card is that this is a state constitutionally based evidentiary privilege that's different from everything else.
Yes, and the United States Supreme Court says we're not going to decide this issue. Therefore, we rule right now until something has changed. You know, that's what's troubling to me about your French case. I was having a hard time resolving that. In your French case, I guess Foley was the who wrote that opinion. The proffer there was, I want the probation officer, probation records reviewed for evidence of dishonesty and truthfulness. That's it. And you guys ruled that you need an in-camera review. But that's not what Ritchie says. Ritchie says you make a general showing of credibility, attack on a credibility, you get the prosecution a la Brady deciding what's relevant and gives it to you. You make a particularized showing of materiality, you get the in-camera review. In French, you allowed the fishing expedition. That's contrary to both Pacetti, Ritchie, and Davis. You just can't get that upon, I want to look at it to see if anything's helpful to me.
Right, but that's not this case.
No, but it's in conjunction with everything. I'm looking at all the cases in our jurisdiction that have to do with this type of issue. Because our trial courts they're allowing in-camera review willy-nilly or not. You know, and there's nothing consistent here in our jurisdiction about when to allow an in-camera review and under what circumstances and what showing, if any, the defense has to make to pierce anything. So it's confusing here now in our state. But anyway, that's really, I guess, all I have to say is, unless you have anything to ask me, I think I should win, guys, you know.
Thank you. Just briefly, I'd like to clarify. I did find the section of the transcript where I know Mr. Anderson was saying that only the defense was provided with reports, but I do have the citation to the transcript where it shows that the deputy prosecuting attorney was given those, and I'd just like to cite that to you. This is from the transcript of the proceedings, January 5. 2007, before Judge Alm, page 21. I don't know, this is Ms. Murphy, I don't know if we're talking about the same document. I do want to state that just this morning, the victim's father, natural father, did provide me with a copy of a document entitled Psychological Evaluation of that was prepared by Dr. Barbara Rogers, the court. Is that the same one you have, Mr. Harrison? Mr. Harrison, no, I have that one. The one I'm turning over to her individual reports regarding. I don't know, are they joint? Is it a joint report? Because I do have a joint report because these are individual reports, Ms. Murphy. These are separate psychological evaluations. And they are so titled, Psychological Evaluation. So that I just wanted to point out to you that she did have possession of the reports. And, you know, Judge Watanabe, following up on your point, I agree with you that the legislative amendment did say that the legislature may provide for the enactment of privileges that are absolutely confidential and prohibited from disclosure at trial. But I did not see anything in the HRE, Hawaii Rules of Evidence, showing that those particular sections were those sections that have now been deemed absolutely privileged. And I think that's a really great point in this particular case. I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement.